disastrously defeated at the Battle of Culloden Moor. A few months thereafter, Charles Radcliffe died beneath the headsman's axe at the Tower of London. During their stay in France, the Stuarts had been deeply involved in the dissemination of Freemasonry. Indeed, they're generally regarded as the source of the particular form of Freemasonry known as Scottish Rite. Scottish Rite Freemasonry introduced higher degrees than those offered by other Masonic systems at the time. It promised initiation into greater and more profound mysteries, mysteries supposedly preserved and handed down in Scotland. It established more direct connections between Freemasonry and the various activities, alchemy, Kabbalism, and Hermetic thought, for instance, which were regarded as Rosicrucian, and it elaborated not only on the antiquity, but also on the illustrious pedigree of the craft. It is probable that Scottish Rite Freemasonry was originally promulgated, if not indeed devised, by Charles Radcliffe. In any case, Radcliffe, in 1725, is said to have founded the first Masonic lodge on the continent in Paris. During the same year, or perhaps in the year following, he seems to have been acknowledged Grand Master of all French lodges, and is still cited as such a decade later in 1736. The dissemination of 18th-century Freemasonry owes more ultimately to Radcliffe than to any other man. Despite Radcliffe's premature death in 1746, the seeds he had sown in Europe continued to bear fruit. Early in the 1750s, a new ambassador of Freemasonry appeared, a German named Karl Gottlieb von Hundt. Hundt claimed to have been initiated in 1742, a year before Ramsay's death, 4 years before Radcliffe's. At his initiation, he claimed, he had been introduced to a new system of Freemasonry confided to him by unknown superiors. These unknown superiors, Hundt maintained, were closely associated with the Jacobite cause. Indeed, he even believed at first that the man who presided over his initiation was Bonnie Prince Charlie, and although this proved not to be the case, Hundt remained convinced that the unidentified personage in question was intimately connected with the young pretender. It seems reasonable to suppose that the man who actually presided was Charles Radcliffe. The system of Freemasonry to which Hundt was introduced was subsequently called Strict Observance, and the basic tenet of the Strict Observance was that it had descended directly from the Knights Templar, some of whom had purportedly survived the purge of 1307 to 1314 and perpetuated their order in Scotland. We were already familiar with this claim. Because the papal bull dissolving the Templars was never promulgated in Scotland, the order was never officially suppressed there, and we ourselves had located what seemed to be a Templar graveyard in Argyllshire. The pedigree Hundt claimed for the Strict Observance did not, therefore, seem to us altogether improbable. To his own embarrassment and subsequent disgrace, however, he was unable to elaborate further on his new system of Freemasonry. As a result, his contemporaries dismissed him as a charlatan and accused him of having fabricated the story. To these charges, Hundt could only reply that his unknown superiors had inexplicably abandoned him. They had promised to contact him again and give him further instructions, but they had never done so. To the end of his life, he affirmed his integrity, maintaining he had been deserted by his original sponsors. The more we considered Hundt's assertions, the more plausible they sounded, and he appeared to have been a hapless victim, not so much of deliberate betrayal as of circumstances beyond everyone's control. For according to his own account, Hundt had been initiated in 1742, when the Jacobites were still a powerful political force in continental affairs. By 1746, however, Radcliffe was dead. So were many of his colleagues, while others were in prison or exile, as far away in some cases as North America. The fact that Hundt was abandoned immediately after the collapse of the Jacobite cause would seem, if anything, to confirm his story. There is another fragment of evidence which lends credence not only to Hundt's claims, but to the Priory documents as well. This evidence is a list of Grand Masters of the Knights Templar which Hundt insisted he had obtained from his unknown superiors. On the basis of our own research, we have concluded that the list of Templar Grand Masters in the Dossier Secrets was accurate. Save for the spelling of a single surname, the list Hundt produced agreed with the one in the Dossier Secret. Hunt had somehow obtained a list of Templar Grand Masters more accurate than any other known at the time. Moreover, he obtained it when many documents on which we relied, charters, deeds, proclamations, were still sequestered in the Vatican and unobtainable. This would seem to confirm that Hunt's story of unknown superiors was not a fabrication. It would also seem to indicate that those unknown superiors were extraordinarily knowledgeable about the Order of the Temple, more knowledgeable than they could possibly have been without access to privileged sources. In any case, despite the charges levelled against him, Hunt was not left completely friendless. After the collapse of the Jacobite cause, he found a sympathetic patron and a close companion in no less a person than the Holy Roman Emperor. The Holy Roman Emperor at this time was François, Duke of Lorraine, who by his marriage to Maria Theresa of Austria in 1735 had linked the houses of Habsburg and Lorraine and inaugurated the Habsburg-Lorraine dynasty. And according to the Prieuré documents, it was François's brother, Charles de Lorraine, who succeeded Radcliffe as Sion's Grand Master. François was the first European prince to become a Mason and to publicize his Masonic affiliations. He was initiated in 1731 at The Hague, a bastion of esoteric activity since Rosicrucian circles had installed themselves there during the Thirty Years' War. And the man who presided over François's initiation was Jean de Saguelier, intimate associate of Newton, Ramsay, and Radcliffe. Shortly after his initiation, moreover, François embarked for a lengthy stay in England. Here he became a member of that innocuous-sounding institution, the Gentlemen's Club of Spalding. In the years that followed, François de Lorraine was probably more responsible than any other European potentate for the spread of Freemasonry. His court at Vienna became, in a sense, Europe's Masonic capital, and a centre for a broad spectrum of other esoteric interests as well. François himself was a practicing alchemist, with an alchemical laboratory in the imperial palace, the Hofburg. On the death of the last Medici, he became Grand Duke of Tuscany, and deftly thwarted the Inquisition's harassment of Freemasons in Florence. Through François, Charles Radcliffe, who had founded the first Masonic lodge on the continent, left a durable legacy. Compared to the important cultural and political figures who preceded him, compared even to a man like Charles Radcliffe, Charles Nodier seemed a most unlikely choice for Grand Master. We knew him primarily as a kind of literary curiosity, a relatively minor belles-lettrist, a somewhat garrulous essayist, a second-rate novelist and short story writer. In his own time, however, Nodier was regarded as a major cultural figure, and his influence was enormous. Moreover, he proved to be connected with our inquiry in a number of surprising ways. By 1824, Nodier was already a literary celebrity. In that year, he was appointed the chief librarian at the Arsenal Library, the major French depository for medieval and specifically occult manuscripts. Among its various treasures, the Arsenal was said to have contained the alchemical works of Nicolas Flamel, the medieval alchemist listed as one of Sion's earlier grand masters. And there were other treasures too. On the outbreak of the French Revolution, monasteries throughout the country had been plundered, and all books and manuscripts sent to Paris for storage. Then, in 1810, Napoleon confiscated and brought to Paris almost the entire archive of the Vatican. Although some of these papers were subsequently returned to Rome, a great many remained in France. And it was material of this sort, occult books and manuscripts, works plundered from monasteries and the archive of the Vatican, that passed through the hands of Nodier and his associates. Methodically, they sifted it, catalogued it, explored it. During his tenure at the Arsenal, Nodier continued to write and publish prolifically. Among the most important of his later works is a massive, lavishly illustrated multi-volume opus of antiquarian interest, devoted to sites of particular consequence in ancient France. In this monumental compendium, Nodier devoted considerable space to the Merovingian epoch, a fact all the more striking in that no one at the time displayed the least interest in the Merovingians. There are also lengthy sections on the Templars, and there's a special article on Gisors, including a detailed account of the mysterious cutting of the elm in 1188, which, according to the Priere documents, marked the separation between the Knights Templar and the Priere de Sion. At the same time, Nodier was more than a librarian and a writer. He was also a gregarious, egocentric, and flamboyant individual who constantly sought the center of attention, and did not hesitate to exaggerate his own importance. In his quarters at the Arsenal Library, he inaugurated a salon which established him as one of the most influential and prestigious aesthetic potentates of the epoch. By the time of his death in 1844, he had served as mentor for a whole generation, many of whom quite eclipsed him in their subsequent achievements. For example, Nodier's chief disciple and closest friend was the young Victor Hugo, Sion's next Grand Master, according to the Priere documents. There was François René de Chateaubriand, who made a special pilgrimage to Poussin's tomb in Rome and had a stone erected there bearing a reproduction of Les Bergers d'Arcadie. There were Balzac, Delacroix, Dumas Père, Lamartine, Musset, Théophile Gautier, Gérard de Nerval, and Alfred de Vigny. Like the poets and painters of the Renaissance, these men often drew heavily on esoteric and especially hermetic tradition. Nodier's literary and esoteric activities were quite clearly pertinent to our investigation. But there was another aspect of his career which was, if anything, more pertinent still. For Nodier, from his childhood, was deeply involved in secret societies. In Paris in 1802, Nodier wrote of his affiliation with a secret society which he described as biblical and Pythagorean. Then, in 1815, he published anonymously one of his most curious and influential works, The History of Secret Societies in the Army. In this book, Nodier is deliberately ambiguous. He does not clarify definitively whether he is writing pure fiction or pure fact. If anything, he implies, the book is a species of thinly disguised allegory of actual historical occurrences. In any case, it develops a comprehensive philosophy of secret societies, and it credits such societies with a number of historical accomplishments, including the downfall of Napoleon. There are a great many secret societies in operation, Nodier declares, but there is one, he adds, that takes precedence over all others, that in fact presides over all others. According to Nodier, this supreme secret society is called the Philadelphs. At the same time, however, he speaks of the oath which binds me to the Philadelphs and which forbids me to make them known under their social name. More than Charles Radcliffe, more than Charles Nodier, Jean Cocteau seemed to us a most unlikely candidate for the grand mastership of an influential secret society. In Radcliffe's and Nodier's cases, however, our investigation had yielded certain connections of considerable interest. In Cocteau's, we discovered very few. Certainly he was raised in a milieu close to the corridors of power. His family were politically prominent, and his uncle was an important diplomat. But Cocteau, at least ostensibly, abandoned this world, leaving home at the age of 15 and plunging into the seedy subculture of Marseille. By 1908, he had established himself in Bohemian artistic circles. In his early 20s, he became associated with Proust, Gide, and Maurice Barré. He was also a close friend of Victor Hugo's great-grandson, Jean, with whom he embarked on assorted excursions into spiritualism and the occult. He quickly became versed in esoterica, and hermetic thinking shaped not only much of his work, but also his entire aesthetic. By 1912, if not earlier, he had begun to consort with Debussy, to whom he alludes frequently, if non-committally, in his journals. In 1926, he designed the set for a production of the opera Pelléas and Mélisande, because, according to one commentator, he was unable to resist linking his name for all time to that of Claude Debussy. Cocteau's private life, which included bouts of drug addiction and a sequence of homosexual affairs, was notoriously erratic. This had fostered an image of him as a volatile and recklessly irresponsible individual. In fact, however, he was always acutely conscious of his public persona, and whatever his personal escapades, he would not let them impede his access to people of influence and power. As he himself admitted, he had always craved public recognition, honour, esteem, even admission to the Académie Française, and he made a point of conforming sufficiently to assure him of the status he sought. Although never ostensibly interested in politics, he denounced the Vichy government during the war, and seems to have been quietly in league with the resistance. In 1949, he was made a Chevalier of the Legion of Honour. In 1958, he was invited by de Gaulle's brother to make a public address on the general subject of France. It is not the kind of role one generally attributes to Cocteau, but he appears to have played it frequently enough and to have relished doing so. For a good part of his life, Cocteau was associated with royalist Catholic circles. At the same time, however, Cocteau's Catholicism was highly unorthodox and seems to have been more aesthetic than a religious commitment. In the latter part of his life, he devoted much of his energy to redecorating churches. Curious echo, perhaps, of Béranger-Saunière. Like Saunière, Cocteau, in his redecorations, incorporated certain curious and suggestive details. Some are visible in the Church of Notre-Dame de France, around the corner from Leicester Square in London. The church itself dates from 1865, and may, at its consecration, have had certain Masonic connections. In 1940, at the peak of the Blitz, it was seriously damaged. Nevertheless, it remained the favourite centre of worship for many important members of the Free French Forces, and after the war it was restored and redecorated by artists from all over France. Among them was Cocteau, who in 1960, 3 years before his death, executed a mural depicting the crucifixion. It is an extremely singular crucifixion. There is a black sun, and a sinister, green-tinged and unidentified figure in the lower right-hand corner. There is a Roman soldier holding a shield with a bird emblazoned on it, a highly stylized bird, suggesting an Egyptian rendering of Horus. Among the mourning women and dice-throwing centurions, there are two incongruously modern figures, one of whom is Cocteau himself, presented as a self-portrait, with his back significantly turned on the cross. Most striking of all is the fact that the mural depicts only the lower portion of the cross. Whoever hangs upon it is visible only as far up as the knees, so that one cannot see the face or determine the identity of who is being crucified. And fixed to the cross, immediately below the anonymous victim's feet, is a gigantic rose. The design is a flagrant rose-croix device, and if nothing else, it is a very singular motif for a Catholic church. The dossier secret, in which the list of Sion's alleged Grand Masters appeared, were dated 1956. Cocteau did not die until 1963. There was thus no indication of who might have succeeded him, or for who might preside over the Prieur de Sion at present. But Cocteau himself posed one additional point of immense interest. Until the cutting of the elm in 1188, the Prieuré documents asserted Sion and the Order of the Temple shared the same Grand Master. After 1188, Sion is said to have chosen a Grand Master of its own, the first of them being Jean de Gisors. According to the Prieuré documents, every Grand Master, on assuming his position, has adopted the name of Jean, John, and since there were four women, Jeanne, Joan. Sion's Grand Masters are therefore alleged to have comprised a continuous succession of Jeans and Jeannes from 1188 to the present. This succession was clearly intended to imply an esoteric and hermetic papacy based on John, in contrast, and perhaps opposition, to the exoteric one based on Peter. One major question, of course, was which John? John the Baptist? John the Evangelist, the beloved disciple in the fourth gospel? Or John the Divine, author of the Book of Revelation? It seemed it must be one of these three because Jean de Gisors, in 1188, had purportedly taken the title of Jean the Second. Who, then, was Jean the First? Whatever the answer to that question, Jean Cocteau appeared on the list of Sion's alleged Grand Masters as Jean the 23rd. In 1959, while Cocteau still presumably held the Grand Mastership, Pope Pius XII died, and the assembled cardinals elected as their new pontiff Cardinal Angelo Roncalli of Venice. Any newly elected pope chooses his own name, and Cardinal Roncalli caused considerable consternation when he chose the name of John the 23rd. Such consternation was not unjustified. In the first place, there had already been a John the 23rd. The anti-pope who abdicated in 1415 was, in fact, John the 23rd. It was thus unusual, to say the least, for Cardinal Roncalli to assume the same name. In 1976, an enigmatic little book was published in Italy and soon after translated into French. It was called The Prophecies of Pope John the 23rd and contained a compilation of obscure prophetic prose poems reputedly composed by the pontiff, who had died 13 years before in 1963, the same year as Cocteau. For the most part, these prophecies are extremely opaque. Whether they are indeed the work of John the 23rd is open to question. But the introduction to the work maintains that they are Pope John's work, and it maintains something further as well, that John the 23rd was secretly a member of the Rose Croix. Needless to say, this assertion sounds incredible. Certainly we found no external evidence to support it, but why, we wondered, should such an assertion even have been made in the first place? Could there be at least a grain of truth in it? The simultaneous rule of John the 23rd over both Sion and Rome would seem to be an extraordinary coincidence. Nor could the Prurie documents have devised a list to create such a coincidence, for the list of Sion's alleged Grand Masters had been composed and deposited in the Bibliothèque Nationale no later than 1956, 3 years before John the 23rd became Pope. Whatever the truth, there is no question that more than any other man, Pope John the 23rd was responsible for reorienting the Roman Catholic Church and bringing it, as commentators have frequently said, into the 20th century. He revised the Church's position on Freemasonry, breaking with at least two centuries of entrenched tradition, and allowing that a Catholic might be a Freemason. And in June 1960, he issued a profoundly important apostolic letter. This missive addressed itself specifically to the subject of the precious blood of Jesus. It ascribed a hitherto unprecedented significance to that blood. It emphasized Jesus' sufferings as a human being and maintained that the redemption of mankind had been effected by the shedding of his blood. In the context of Pope John's letter, Jesus' human passion and the shedding of his blood assume a greater consequence than the resurrection or even the mechanics of the crucifixion. The implications of this letter are ultimately enormous. If man's redemption was achieved by the shedding of Jesus' blood, his death and resurrection became incidental. Jesus need not to have died on the cross for the faith to retain its validity. How were we to synthesize the evidence we had accumulated? Much of it was impressive and seemed to bear witness to something, some pattern, some coherent design. The list of Sion's alleged Grand Masters, however improbable it had originally appeared, now displayed some intriguing consistencies. These consistencies did not necessarily prove anything. They didn't prove, for instance, that the Prieuré de Sion, whose existence during the Middle Ages we had confirmed, had actually continued to survive through the subsequent centuries. Still less did they prove that the individuals cited as Grand Masters actually held that position. It still seemed incredible to us that some of them really did. So far as certain individuals were concerned, the age at which they allegedly became Grand Masters argued against them. Granted, it was possible that Édouard de Bar might have been selected Grand Master at the age of 5, or René d'Anjou at the age of 8, on the basis of some hereditary principle. But no such principle seemed to obtain for Robert Flood or Charles Nodier, who both supposedly became Grand Master at the age of 21, or for Debussy, who supposedly did so age 23. Such individuals would not have had the time to work their way up through the ranks, as one might, for example, in Freemasonry, nor had they even become solidly established in their own spheres. This anomaly made no apparent sense, unless one assumed that Sion's Grand Mastership was often purely symbolic, a ritual position occupied by a figurehead who, perhaps, was not even aware of the status accorded him. However, it proved futile to speculate, at least on the basis of the information we possessed. We therefore turned back to history again, seeking evidence of the Prieuré de Sion elsewhere, in quarters other than the list of alleged Grand Masters. We turned particularly to the fortunes of the House of Lorraine, and some of the other families cited in the Prieuré documents. We sought to verify other statements made in those documents, and we sought additional evidence for the work of a secret society acting more or less covertly behind the scenes. According to the Prieuré documents, Sion, between 1306 and 1480, possessed 9 commanderies. In 1481, when René d'Anjou died, this number was supposedly expanded to 27. The most important are listed as having been situated at Bourges, Gisors, Jarnac, Mont-Saint-Michel, Montreval, Paris, Le Puy, Solesmes, and Sternay. And the dossier's secrets add cryptically, there was an arch called Bethania, House of Anne, situated at Rennes-le-Château. It's not clear precisely what this passage means, except that Rennes-le-Château would appear to enjoy some kind of highly special significance. And surely it cannot be coincidental that Saunière, on building his villa, then christened it Villa Bethania. According to the dossier's secrets, the commandery at Gisors dated from 1306 and was situated in the Rue de Vienne. From here it supposedly communicated, via an underground passageway, with the local cemetery and with the subterranean chapel of Sainte Catherine, located beneath the fortress. In the 16th century, this chapel, or perhaps a crypt adjacent to it, is said to have become a depository for the archives of the Prieuré de Sion, housed in 30 coffers. Early in 1944, when Gisors was occupied by German personnel, a special military mission was sent from Berlin with instructions to plan a series of excavations beneath the fortress. The Allied invasion of Normandy thwarted any such undertaking, but not long after, a French workman named Roger Lomois embarked on excavations of his own. In 1946, Lomois announced to the mayor of Gisors that he had found an underground chapel containing 19 sarcophagi of stone and 30 coffers of metal. His petition to excavate further was delayed by a welter of official red tape. At last, in 1962, Lomois commenced his requested excavations at Gisors. They were conducted under the auspices of André Malraux, French Minister of Culture at the time, and were not officially open to the public. Certainly no coffers or sarcophagi were found. Whether the underground chapel was found has been debated. Lomois insisted he did find his way again to the chapel, but its contents had been removed. Whatever the truth of the matter, there is mention of the subterranean chapel of Sainte Catherine in 2 old manuscripts, one dated 1696 and the other 1375. On this basis, Lomois' story at least becomes plausible. So does the assertion that the subterranean chapel was a depository for Sion's archives. For we, in our own research, found conclusive proof that the Prieuré de Sion continued to exist for at least 3 centuries after the Crusades and the dissolution of the Knights Templar. Between the early 14th and early 17th centuries, for example, documents pertinent to Orléans and to Sion's base there at Saint-Sampson make sporadic references to the order. Thus it is on record that in the early 16th century, members of the Prieuré de Sion at Orléans, by flouting their rule and refusing to live in common, incurred the displeasure of the Pope and the King of France. Towards the end of the 15th century, the order was also accused of a number of offences, failing to observe their rule, living individually rather than in common, being licentious, residing outside the walls of Saint-Sampson, boycotting divine services, and neglecting to rebuild the walls of the house, which had been seriously damaged in 1562. By 1619, the authorities seem to have lost patience. In that year, according to the records, the Prieuré de Sion was evicted from Saint-Sampson, and the house was made over to the Jesuits. We couldn't reconcile the apparently remiss occupants of Saint-Sampson with the celebrated and legendary Rose Croix. According to the Prieuré documents, Sion was an organization of considerable power and influence, responsible for creating the Templars and manipulating the course of international affairs. The references we found suggested nothing of such magnitude. One possible explanation, of course, was that Saint-Sampson at Orléans was but an isolated seat and probably a minor one of Sion's activities. And indeed, the list of Sion's important commanderies in the dossier's secrets does not even include Orléans. If Sion was, in fact, a force to be reckoned with, Orléans can only have been one small fragment of a much broader pattern. And if this were the case, we would have to look for traces of the order elsewhere. During the 16th century, the House of Lorraine and its cadet branch, the House of Guise, made a concerted and determined attempt to topple the Valois dynasty of France and claim the French throne. This attempt, on several occasions, came within a hair's breadth of dazzling success. The attempt to seize the French throne extended across three generations of the Guise and Lorraine families. It came closest to success in the 1550s and 1560s, under the auspices of Charles, Cardinal of Lorraine, and his brother, François, Duke of Guise. Both François and his brother have been stigmatized by later historians as rabidly bigoted and fanatic Catholics, intolerant, brutal, and bloodthirsty. But there is substantial evidence to suggest that this reputation is to some extent unwarranted, at least as far as adherence to Catholicism is concerned. François and his brother appear quite patently to have been brazen opportunists, courting both Catholics and Protestants in the name of their ulterior design. By 1563, François de Guise was already virtually king when he fell to an assassin's bullet. His brother, the Cardinal of Lorraine, died 12 years later in 1575. But the vendetta against the French royal line did not cease. In 1584, the new Duke of Guise and the new Cardinal of Lorraine embarked on a fresh assault against the throne. Their chief ally in this enterprise was Louis de Gonzaga, Duke of Nevers, who, according to the Prieuré documents, had become Grand Master of Sion 9 years before. By the end of the century, the Valois were at last extinct, but the House of Guise had bled itself to death in the process and could put forward no eligible candidate for a throne that finally lay within its grasp. It's simply not known whether there was an organized secret society or secret order supporting the houses of Guise and Lorraine. Certainly, they were aided by an international network of emissaries, ambassadors, assassins, agents provocateurs, spies and agents who might well have comprised such a clandestine institution. According to Gérard de Sade, one of these agents was Nostradamus. If Nostradamus was an agent for the houses of Guise and Lorraine, he would have been responsible not only for providing them with important information concerning the activities and plans of their adversaries, but he would also, in his capacity as astrologer to the French court, have been privy to all manner of intimate secrets, as well as quirks and weaknesses of personality. By playing on vulnerabilities with which he had become acquainted, he could have psychologically manipulated the Valois into the hands of their enemies, and by virtue of his familiarity with their horoscopes, he might well have advised their enemies on, say, an apparently propitious moment for assassination. Many of Nostradamus's prophecies may not have been prophecies at all. They may have been cryptic messages, ciphers, schedules, timetables, instructions, blueprints for action. Whether this was actually the case or not, there's no question that some of Nostradamus's prophecies were not prophecies, but referred quite explicitly to the past, to the Knights Templar, the Merovingian dynasty, the history of the House of Lorraine. A striking number of them refer to the Razers, the old Comte of Rennes-le-Château, and the numerous quatrains which refer to the advent of Le Grand Monarque, the Great Monarch, indicate that this sovereign will derive ultimately from the Languedoc. According to Gérard de Sade, as well as to popular legend, Nostradamus, before embarking on his career as prophet, spent considerable time in Lorraine. By the mid-1620s, the throne of France was occupied by Louis XIII, but the power behind the throne, and the real architect of French policy, was the king's prime minister, Cardinal Richelieu. Richelieu is generally acknowledged to have been the supreme machinator of his age. He may have been something more as well. While Richelieu established unprecedented stability in France, the rest of Europe, and especially Germany, flamed in the throes of the Thirty Years' War. On one side were the staunchly Catholic forces of Spain and Austria, on the other were the Protestant armies of Sweden and the small German principalities, including the Palatinate of the Rhine, whose rulers, Elector Frederick and his wife Elizabeth Stuart, were in exile at The Hague. In 1633, Cardinal Richelieu brought France into the Thirty Years' War, but not on the side one would expect. Europe was taken aback by the unprecedented action of a Catholic cardinal presiding over a Catholic country, dispatching Catholic troops to fight on the Protestant side against other Catholics. No historian has ever suggested that Richelieu was a Rosicrucian, but he could not possibly have done anything more in keeping with the Rosicrucian attitudes, or more likely to win him Rosicrucian favour. In the meantime, the House of Lorraine had again begun to aspire to the French throne. This time, the claimant was Gaston d'Orléans, younger brother of Louis XIII. Gaston was not himself of the House of Lorraine. In 1632, however, he had married the Duke of Lorraine's sister. His heir would thus carry Lorraine blood on the maternal side, and if Gaston ascended the throne, Lorraine would preside over France within another generation. This prospect was sufficient to mobilize support. Among those asserting Gaston's right of succession, we found an individual we had encountered before, Charles, Duke of Guise. Attempts to depose Louis in favor of Gaston failed, but time, it seemed, was on Gaston's side. For Louis XIII and his wife, Anne of Austria, remained childless. But then, in 1638, after 23 years of marriage, Anne of Austria suddenly produced a child. Few people at the time believed in the boy's legitimacy, and there is still considerable doubt about it. According to both contemporary and later writers, the child's true father was Cardinal Richelieu, or perhaps his protege and successor, Cardinal Mazarin. The birth of an heir to Louis XIII was a serious blow to the hopes of Gaston d'Orléans and the House of Lorraine. And when Louis and Richelieu both died in 1642, the first in a series of concerted attempts was launched to oust Mazarin and keep the young Louis XIV from the throne. These attempts, which began as popular uprisings, culminated in a civil war that flared intermittently for 10 years. To historians, that war is known as the Fronde. The headquarters and capital of the Frondeurs was, significantly enough, the ancient Ardennes town of Stenay. According to the Prieuré documents, the Prieuré de Sion was not, strictly speaking, a perpetuation or continuation of the Order of the Temple. On the contrary, the text stresses emphatically that the separation between the two orders dates from the cutting of the elm in 1188. Apparently, however, some kind of rapport continued to exist, and in 1307, Guillaume de Gisors received the golden head, caput LVIIIM, from the Order of the Temple. Our investigation of the Templars had already acquainted us with this mysterious head. To link it with Sion, however, and with the seemingly important Gisors family, again struck us as dubious, as if the Prieuré documents were straining to make powerful and evocative connections. And yet it was precisely on this point that we found some of our most solid and intriguing confirmation. According to the official records of the Inquisition, the guardian and administrator of the goods of the temple at Paris after the arrests was a man of the king named Guillaume Pidoy. Before the inquisitors on May the 11th, 1308, he declared that at the time of the arrest of the Knights Templar, he, together with his colleague, Guillaume de Gisors, and one Reynard Bourdon, had been ordered to present to the Inquisition all the figures of metal or wood they had found. Among the goods of the temple, they had found a large head of silver gilt, the image of a woman, which Guillaume, on May the 11th, presented before the Inquisition. The head carried a label, Caput LVIIIM. If the head continued to baffle us, the context in which Guillaume de Gisors appeared was equally perplexing. He is specifically cited as being a colleague of Guillaume Pidoy, one of King Philippe's men. In other words, he, like Philippe, would seem to have been hostile to the Templars and participated in the attack upon them. According to the Prieuré documents, however, Guillaume was Grand Master of the Prieuré de Sion at the time. Did this mean that Sion endorsed Philippe's action against the temple, perhaps even collaborated in it? There are certain Prieuré documents which hint that this may have been the case, that Sion, in some unspecified way, authorized and presided over the dissolution of its unruly protégés. On the other hand, the Prieuré documents also imply that Sion exercised a kind of paternal protectiveness towards at least certain Templars during the Order's last days. If this is true, Guillaume de Gisors might well have been a double agent. He might well have been responsible for the leak of Philippe's plans, the means whereby the Templars received advance warning of the king's machinations against them. If, after the formal separation in 1188, Sion did in fact continue to exercise some clandestine control over temple affairs, Guillaume de Gisors might have been partially responsible for the careful destruction of the order's documents and the unexplained disappearance of its treasure. In addition to the fragmentary information we've discussed, the text in the Dossier Secret includes three lists of names. The first of these is straightforward enough, being merely a list of abbots who presided over Sion's lands in Palestine between 1152 and 1281. Our research confirmed its veracity. It appears elsewhere independent of the Dossier Secret and in accessible, unimpugnable sources. The lists in these sources agree with that in the Dossier Secret, except that two names are missing in the sources. The second list in the Dossier Secret is a list of the Grand Masters of the Knights of Templar from 1118 until 1190, from the temple's public foundation until its separation from Sion. At first, there seemed nothing unusual or extraordinary about the list. When we compared it to other lists, however, those cited by acknowledged historians writing on the Templars, for instance, certain obvious discrepancies quickly emerged. According to virtually all other known lists, there were 10 Grand Masters between 1118 and 1190. According to the Dossier Secret, there were only 8. According to most other lists, André de Montpin, Saint Bernard's uncle, was not only co-founder of the order, but also its Grand Master between 1153 and 1156. According to the Dossier Secret, however, André was never Grand Master, but would seem to have continued functioning as he does all through his career, behind the scenes. According to most other lists, Bertrand de Blanchefort appears as 6th Grand Master of the Temple, assuming his office after André de Montbard in 1156. According to the Dossier Secret, Bertrand is not 6th, but 4th in succession, becoming Grand Master in 1153. There were other such discrepancies and contradictions, and we were uncertain what to make of them. Because it disagreed with those compiled by established historians, were we to regard the list in the Dossier Secret as wrong? It must be emphasized that no official or definitive list of the temple's Grand Masters exists. The earliest known compilation of the order's Grand Masters dates from 1342, 30 years after the order itself was suppressed, and 225 years after its foundation. As a result, historians compiling lists of Grand Masters have based their findings on contemporary chroniclers, on a man writing in 1170, for example, who makes a passing allusion to one or another individual as Master or Grand Master of the Temple. And additional evidence can be obtained by examining documents and charters of the period in which one or another Templar official would append one or another title to his signature. It is thus hardly surprising that the sequence and dating of Grand Masters should engender considerable uncertainty and confusion. Most of the discrepancies between the list in the Dossier Secret and those in other sources can be explained fairly easily. At this point, it's not worth exploring each such discrepancy and accounting for it, but a single example should serve to illustrate how and why such discrepancies might occur. In addition to the Grand Master, the temple had a multitude of local masters, a master for England, for Normandy, for Aquitaine. There was also an overall European master, and it would appear a maritime master as well. In documents and charters, these local or regional masters would invariably sign themselves Magister Templi, Master of the Temple, and on most occasions the Grand Master would also sign himself as nothing more than Magister Templi. It is thus not difficult to see how a historian might misconstrue André's true status in the order. We spent more than a year considering and comparing various lists of Templar Grand Masters. We consulted all writers on the order and then checked their sources as well. We examined the chronicles of the time. We consulted all the charters we could find and obtained comprehensive information on all those known to be extant. We compared signatories and titles on numerous proclamations, edicts, deeds, and other Templar documents. As a result of this exhaustive inquiry, it became apparent that the list in the dossier's secrets was more accurate than any other, not only on the identity of the Grand Masters, but on the dates of their respective regimes as well. If a definitive list of the temple's Grand Masters did exist, it was in the dossier secret. Such a list might perhaps have been compiled by an extremely careful researcher, but the task would have been monumental. It seemed much more likely to us that a list of such accuracy attested to some repository of privileged or inside information. Whether our conclusion was warranted or not, we were confronted by one indisputable fact. Someone had obtained access, somehow, to a list which was more accurate than any other, and since that list, despite its divergence from others more accepted, proved so frequently to be correct, it lent considerable credibility to the Priore documents as a whole. Such reassurance was both timely and necessary. Without it, we might well have dismissed the third list in the dossier secrets out of hand. For this third list, even at a cursory glance, seemed absurd. The third list in the dossier secret was of the Grand Masters of the Priore de Sion, or to use the official term, Nautonnier, an old French word which means navigator or helmsman. When we first saw this list, it immediately provoked our skepticism. On the one hand, it includes a number of names which one would automatically expect to find on such a list, names of famous individuals associated with the occult and esoteric. Nicolas Flamel, for instance, is perhaps the most famous and well-documented of medieval alchemists. Robert Fludd, 17th-century philosopher, was an exponent of Hermetic thought and other arcane subjects. Johann Valentin Andria, German contemporary of Fludd, composed, among other things, some of the works which spawned the myth of the fabulous Christian Rosenkreutz. The list also includes a number of illustrious and improbable names. Names like Leonardo da Vinci and Sandro Filippi, who is better known as Botticelli. There are names of distinguished scientists like Robert Boyle and Sir Isaac Newton. During the last two centuries, the Priore de Sion's Grand Masters are alleged to have included such important literary and cultural figures as Victor Hugo, Claude Debussy, and Jean Cocteau. By including such names, the list in the dossier secret could not but appear suspect. It was almost inconceivable that some of the individuals cited had presided over a secret society, and still more, a secret society devoted to occult and esoteric interests. Boyle and Newton, for example, are hardly names that people in the 20th century associate with the occult and esoteric. And though Hugo, Debussy, and Cocteau were immersed in such matters, they would seem to be too well known, too well researched and documented to have exercised a grand mastership over a secret order. Not at any rate without some word of it somehow leaking out. On the other hand, the distinguished names are not the only names on the list. Most of the others belong to high-ranking European nobles, many of whom are extremely obscure, unfamiliar not only to the general reader, but even to the professional historian. There is Guillaume de Gisors, for instance, who in 1306 is said to have organized the Priore de Sion into an hermetic Freemasonry. And there is Guillaume's grandfather, Jean de Gisors, who is said to have been Sion's first independent Grand Master, assuming his position after the cutting of the elm and the separation from the temple in 1188. There is no question that Jean de Gisors existed. He was born in 1133 and died in 1220. He is mentioned in charters, and was at least nominal lord of the famous fortress in Normandy, where meetings traditionally convened between English and French kings took place, as did the cutting of the elm in 1188. Like the other aristocratic names on the list of Sion's Grand Masters, Jean de Gisors appeared in the complicated genealogies which figured elsewhere in the Prieuré's documents. Together with those other elusive nobles, he apparently belonged to the same dense forest of family trees, ultimately descended, supposedly, from the Merovingian dynasty. It thus seemed evident to us that the Prieuré de Sion, to a significant extent at least, was a domestic affair. In some way the order appeared to be intimately associated with a bloodline and a lineage, and it was their connection with this bloodline or lineage that perhaps accounted for the various titled names on the list of Grand Masters. It would seem that Sion's Grand Mastership had recurrently shifted between two essentially distinct groups of individuals. On the one hand, there are the figures of monumental stature who, through esoterica, the arts, or sciences, have produced some impact on Western tradition, history, and culture. On the other hand, there are members of a specific and interlinked network of families, noble, and sometimes royal. In this respect at least, the Prieuré de Sion would seem to be both modest and realistic. It does not claim to have functioned under the auspices of geniuses, saints, sages, or immortals. On the contrary, it acknowledges its grand masters to have been fallible human beings. A few geniuses, a few notables, a few average specimens, a few nonentities, even a few fools. Why, we could not but wonder, would a forged or fabricated list include such a spectrum? If one wishes to contrive a list of grand masters, why not make all the names on it illustrious? If one wishes to concoct a pedigree which includes Leonardo, Newton, and Victor Hugo, why not also include Dante, Michelangelo, Goethe, and Tolstoy, instead of obscure people like Edouard de Bas and Maximilien de Lorraine? Why a relatively minor writer like Charles Nodier, rather than contemporaries like Byron or Pushkin? Why an apparent eccentric like Cocteau, rather than men of such international prestige as André Gide or Albert Camus? And why the omission of individuals like Poussin, whose connection with the mystery had already been established? Such questions nagged at us, and argued that the list warranted consideration before we dismissed it as an arrant fraud. We therefore embarked on a lengthy and detailed study of the alleged Grand Masters, their biographies, activities, and accomplishments. In conducting this study, we tried as far as we could to subject each name on the list to certain critical questions. Was there any personal contact, direct or indirect, between each alleged Grand Master, his immediate predecessor and an immediate successor? Was there any affiliation, by blood or otherwise, between each alleged Grand Master and the families who figured in the genealogies of the Prieuré documents, with any of the families of purported Merovingian descent, and especially the ducal house of Lorraine? Was each alleged Grand Master in any way connected with Rennes-le-Château, Gisors, Sternay, Saint-Sulpice, or any of the other sites that had recurred in the course of our previous investigation? If Sion defined itself as a hermetic Freemasonry, did each alleged Grand Master display a predisposition towards hermetic thought or an involvement with secret societies? Although information on the alleged Grand Masters before 1400 was difficult, sometimes impossible, to obtain, our investigation of the later figures yields some astonishing results and consistency. Many of them were associated in one way or another with one or more of the sites that seemed to be relevant, Rennes-le-Château, Gisors, Sternay, or Saint-Sulpice. Most of the names on the list were either allied by blood to the House of Lorraine or associated with it in some other fashion. Even Robert Flood, for example, served as tutor to the sons of the Duke of Lorraine. From Nicolas Flamel in 1398 on, every name on the list was steeped in hermetic thought, and often also associated with secret societies. And with only one exception, each alleged Grand Master had some contact, sometimes direct, sometimes through close mutual friends, with those who preceded and succeeded him. It's not feasible to discuss each alleged Grand Master in detail. Some of the more obscure figures assume significance only against the background of a given age, and to explain this significance fully would entail lengthy digressions into forgotten byways of history. In the case of the more famous names, it would be impossible to do them justice in the time available. Rather, we would dwell on broader social and cultural developments in which a succession of alleged Grand Masters play a collective part. It was in such social and cultural developments that our research seemed to yield a discernible trace of the Prieuré de Sion's hand. Although little known today, René d'Anjou, Good King René, as he was known, was one of the most important figures in European culture during the years immediately preceding the Renaissance. Born in 1408, during his life he came to hold an awesome array of titles. Among the most important were Count of Bar, Count of Provence, Count of Piedmont, Count of Guise, Duke of Calabria, Duke of Anjou, Duke of Lorraine, King of Hungary, King of Naples and Sicily, King of Aragon, Valencia, Mallorca and Sardinia, and perhaps most resonant of all, King of Jerusalem. This last was, of course, purely titular. Still, it evoked a continuity extending back to Godefroy de Bouillon and was acknowledged by other European potentates. One of René's daughters, Marguerite d'Anjou, in 1445, married Henry VI of England and played a prominent role in the War of the Roses. Unlike many of his contemporaries, René was less a warrior than a courtier. An extremely literate person, he wrote prolifically and illuminated his own books. He composed poetry and mystical allegories, as well as compendiums of tournament rules. He sought to promote the advancement of knowledge, and at one time employed Christopher Columbus. He was steeped in esoteric tradition, and his court included a Jewish astrologer, Kabbalist and physician known as Jean de Saint-Remy. According to a number of accounts, Jean de Saint-Remy was the grandfather of Nostradamus, the famous 16th-century prophet who was also to figure in our story. René's interests included chivalry and the Arthurian and Grail romances. Indeed, he seems to have had a particular preoccupation with the Grail. He is said to have taken great pride in a magnificent cup of red porphyry, which, he asserted, had been used at the wedding at Cana. He had obtained it, he claimed, at Marseille, where the Magdalene, according to tradition, landed with the Grail. Other chroniclers speak of a cup in René's possession, perhaps the same one, which bore a mysterious inscription incised into the rim. Qui bien beurra, Dieu voira. Qui beurra tout d'une baleine, voira Dieu et la Madeleine. He who drinks well will see God. He who quaffs at a single draught will see God and the Magdalene. It would not be inaccurate to regard René d'Anjou as a major impetus behind the phenomenon now called the Renaissance. By virtue of his numerous Italian possessions, he spent some years in Italy, and through his intimate friendship with the ruling Forza family of Milan, he established contact with the Medicis of Florence. There is good reason to believe that it was largely René's influence which prompted Cosimo de' Medici to embark on a series of ambitious projects destined to transform Western civilization. In 1439, while René was resident in Italy, Cosimo de' Medici began sending his agents all over the world in quest of ancient manuscripts. Then, in 1444, Cosimo founded Europe's first public library, the Library of San Marco. At Cosimo's express commission, the corpus of Platonic, Neoplatonic, Pythagorean, Gnostic, and Hermetic thought found its way into translation for the first time and became readily accessible. Cosimo also undertook to create an academy of Pythagorean and Platonic studies. Cosimo's academy quickly generated a multitude of similar institutions throughout the Italian peninsula, and from them the high culture of the Renaissance began to blossom. René d'Anjou not only contributed in some measure to the formation of the academies, but also seems to have conferred upon them one of their favourite symbolic themes, that of Arcadia. Certainly it is in René's own career that the motif of Arcadia appears to have made its debut in post-Christian Western culture. In 1449, for example, at his court of Tarascon, René staged a series of pas d'armes, curious hybrid amalgams of tournament and masque, in which knights tilted against each other and at the same time performed a species of drama or play. One of René's most famous pas d'armes was called the pas d'armes of the shepherdess. Played by his mistress at the time, the shepherdess was an explicitly Arcadian figure, embodying both romantic and philosophical attributes. She presided over a tourney in which knights assumed allegorical identities representing conflicting values and ideas. The event was a singular fusion of the pastoral Arcadian romance with the pageantry of the Round Table and the mysteries of the Holy Grail. Arcadia figures elsewhere in René's work as well. It is frequently denoted by a fountain or tombstone, both of which are associated with an underground stream. The stream is usually equated with